Hi, welcome.
Welcome back. How Many Podcast, episode four. Yeah, that's right. Episode four.
I'm Erin.
I'm Casey.
And today we have our first guest.
Special guest.
Self-described former wellness junkie turned Bitcoiner. She recently published an article called Is Bitcoin Changing the Way the Left Thinks? Published in Bitcoin Magazine. We will link it in the description. You should all read it. Also friend of the pod, fellow Bay Area Bitcoiner.
That's where we all met, the Bay Area Bitcoin. We met at the Bay Area Bitcoin meetup for the first time.
We did.
Yep. And we met at the Bay Area Bitcoin for the meetup for the first time. Presumably you guys met for the first time at the Bay Area.
We found love in a hopeless place.
Bay Area Bitcoin for life. We roll pretty deep, the Bay Area Bitcoiners. Yeah. So,
but yeah, Isabel Fox and Duke joining us. Happy to have you.
Honor to be here.
It must be a little intimidating to be on such a prestigious and well-known
I will say venue. It's quite the bit of pressure to be the first guest, but you know, I think I will do my best. I will do you proud.
I think you're going to do a great job, honestly. And it's good to spice up the dynamic. Casey was not convinced that we could have a third guest and have it not be weird. He was like, how do you have a three-person conversation?
I'm not good at having conversations with more than one person.
Oh, I love it. We do this all the time. This is what we do at
this
the bars.
This is what we do.
This is literally what we do at meetups.
Yeah, but I mean, like a podcast where, like, you know, I'm like, oh, am I saying enough? Am I not saying enough? You know, that kind of thing.
You're often saying enough.
Okay. Good. A little jab in there.
I'm not worried about you running out of words, Casey.
But yeah, so I mean, really the main thing we wanted to talk with Isabel about is obviously her new article. This is like your first like Bitcoin related publication. You've done writing in the past and now you're like really going into the Bitcoin world.
Yes. I've done a little bit of like podcasting around Bitcoin, other sort of Bitcoin media things, but this was sort of like the first big, real thoughtful piece that I put out into the world. And it was largely, you know, inspired by personal experiences around coming into the Bitcoin community, which is often, feels pretty red, especially when you get into Bitcoin Twitter, you know, it can feel like a very conservative place. And that was a little intimidating for me as somebody who kind of grew up in a super, super liberal environment my whole life, live in San Francisco now. And so, yeah, so I was sort of grappling with that as I was learning about Bitcoin and getting deeper into the Bitcoin world, as I think a lot of folks who are in Bitcoin and have that background do. And so I wrote this article about kind of my journey, my personal journey of sort of how I reconciled my kind of, I guess, perspective on Bitcoin as a person who has this particular background around, I guess, economic policy and politics in general.
Right.
How did that like happen initially? Did you see Bitcoin and you were like, ooh, this is like for right-wing people? Or did you see Bitcoin and you didn't realize that it had been politicized or that it tended to be politicized?
I didn't realize it was politicized. I mean, when I first heard about Bitcoin, I immediately thought, oh my gosh, Democrats must love this. Like, this is so like the money for the people. And this is something I talk about really early on in the article, was being really shocked when kind of left-leaning folks in Democratic Party were so anti-Bitcoin. I didn't really understand it, because to me it seemed like something that really helps narrow the wealth gap, right? I mean, that was sort of the frame for how I understood Bitcoin, was like, oh, you know, currency debasement is so clearly being used to make the rich richer, and it's basically effectively stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. I mean, that's how currency debasement works. And so this felt like an obvious solution to that problem. And so, you know, as somebody who is sort of coming from the lens of let's narrow the wealth gap, like how do we, you know, equalize the playing field for all players, that just felt like an obvious thing to do.
Yeah,
and then I didn't really understand why Democrats wouldn't like that, or why like liberal folks would have a problem with that. I actually think a lot of them just simply don't, you know, haven't looked into Bitcoin, because there's so much FUD around Bitcoin in liberal media for all sorts of reasons, which we can get into. I think that's actually a really important conversation to have. But I think a lot of people, like, if they understood how Bitcoin worked and how currency debasement worked, they would actually say, oh, this is in alignment with my values. Like, this does help clearly narrow the wealth gap. And they just haven't even really thought about it, including, by the way, a lot of politicians. Like, I wonder sometimes if Elizabeth Warren even really understands
how this... has no fucking clue.
I think people have this perception of Bitcoin as being this sort of, you know, big tool of capitalism, which of course it is on the one hand, but on the other hand, it is again clearly a wealth gap narrower rather than a wealth gap widener, which is something that, you know, the left should be all over, in my opinion. So
I had a similar kind of experience where I didn't think of it as being politicized, or I thought like, oh, there's a certain type of person that would like this. And then I was kind of surprised to see that they didn't. But for me, it wasn't so much the like economic side of it. It was the privacy side. Like I thought like, okay, Edward Snowden, like WikiLeaks, this kind of like the government's watching us, like privacy sort of thing. That was what I was like, oh, the left must like this because it's like not allowing as much control or whatever. And then sort of realizing like, oh wait, maybe they like big government.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like you're kind of like, oh my, it kind of makes you question everything. You know, yeah. It's like on the one hand, it's like the things that I love about kind of the general liberal politics is this concept of freedom, human rights, LGBTQ rights, women's right to choose, right? All these things that we talk about on the left all the time. And then there's this sort of like other side of it where actually there's a lot of control happening on the left. And I think the right has the opposite experience where, you know, they are, you know, folks on the right are often talking about privacy and freedom and all these things, but not when it comes to women's bodies or not when it comes to, you know, religion. I mean, well, I won't get into that. But, so there's like hypocrisy happening on all sides. You know, there's
definitely no shortage of hypocrisy.
Right. There's no shortage of hypocrisy. There's hypocrisy happening on all sides. And I think that I was, you know, blind to where it was happening on quote unquote my side of the aisle. And now I'm sort of having my eyes opened to where there's hypocrisy on the left when it comes to things like freedom and justice in all sorts of ways. And, you know, I really hope that that, you know, opens up the conversation for folks on the right to do the same, because I think it's happening in the kind of opposite ways on the right side.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah. I also think like with the left, I mean, maybe not like serious leftists, but like casual leftists that are just like, oh yeah, I vote blue, whatever. I think a lot of them just have an aversion to thinking about anything economic. Like they're just like, money is fake and I hate it. And I wish that it didn't exist. And they associate Bitcoin or like maybe crypto in general, and then Bitcoin under crypto as being like a finance guy thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
Yes. Right. Like it's just a branding issue.
Yeah.
Like it's just like,
we're the rebrand.
Right.
There's sort of like negative, there's like a lot of negativity around money and capitalism, but then a lot of positivity around like freedom and like individual freedom. And there's like some tension there, right? Because, you know, in some sense, capitalism is freedom. Like what you get when you give people the freedom to kind of do what you want is you get like private management of capital. So there's like tension there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, like the branding around money in general, like, because I think people think that Bitcoin, they hear the word Bitcoin, they immediately think of the branding of this sort of kind of gross finance system that we're living under. Yeah. And, you know, what we're all thinking once we actually get to know Bitcoin is like, no, this is the answer to all of that crap.
Yeah.
You know, like this is the revolution that's going to change the way all of those problems are created, you know, so... yeah, that's how I've come to think about Bitcoin anyway. It's the answer to the finance bros.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like the closest to a finance bro on the pod. Feel a little uncomfortable with that, but that's okay.
It's the answer to the finance
bro. I don't think of you as a finance bro at all. I think of you as definitely like a Bay Area techie type, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you're a techie.
Yeah, you're like,
I think I'm more of a finance bro.
You're a programmer bro.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an upgrade, I guess.
You don't have like a fratty vibe.
No, this is true.
You do not have a fratty vibe. No.
So you're good.
Okay,
yeah, fine. Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, like, I feel like we first initially bonded partially because we were coming into this at the same time, partially because we were coming at it from like a left-wing perspective and sort of like having our eyes open, partially also because you like astrology, which
yeah,
I love.
I
feel like you've worn many hats in your life. And I'm just like curious, like, you know, you've talked a little bit about like your journey from like leftism to Bitcoin or the way that like Bitcoin made you like question your politics. But like, I don't know, do you feel like you have like an overarching ideology that you're like trying to figure out, or are you just kind of like going with things and like resonating with certain things? And like,
ooh, yeah, I go where the energy is. I follow the Tao.
Okay, we're a vibes podcast.
This is what I told Aaron when we went to the Bitcoin conference in Miami, and I didn't know anyone really other than the Bitcoin Bay Area, the Bay Area Bitcoiners. Did you guys know? I mean, you probably did.
No. Yeah, I've been hanging out at the Bitcoin meetups for a while. Did I know other people? Yeah, I knew a bunch of devs.
Yeah, right. You knew people. You've been in this space for a long time, but I didn't really know that many folks outside of the Bitcoin area, Bay Area people. And so I was really just like, okay, open to where the energy took us. And that became sort of a little bit of a motto for the trip, like follow the DAO, follow where the energy is flowing, right? And yeah, I would say that that is my motto for life in general, right? Is just like, see what happens. I mean, I made this huge career transition very recently that I think is like, you know, I just, you got to do what you feel called to do, you know?
And, yeah.
But I mean, to answer your question, I think I'm pretty action oriented as a person. Like once I've decided that I'm interested in something, I'll just attack it. And maybe that's unique. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I relate to it a lot. I feel like for me, I have like these sort of like seemingly irreconcilable interests that I'm like, oh no, what if this part of my identity finds out about this part of my identity? What's it going to do? And like Bitcoin and leftism can like be one of those things, right? But I think it's like, totally.
It's
beautiful.
It is. You know? Yeah, exactly. I mean, you wouldn't believe after I wrote this article, all of these, you know, people came out of the woodwork saying like, I'm a progressive Bitcoiner. Mm. Like, nice to meet you. I got multiple requests for conversations and like asked to be in like Twitter spaces and like, you know, all of these folks.
I was super nervous about, because we talked about the article before you wrote it, like leading up to it. And I was like, you have a tough row to hoe. The left hates Bitcoin. Like there is no way you are going to be able to convince anybody. Like it's exactly
Casey
diametry.
Did not believe in me. You did not believe in me. Yeah, you
I believe in you. I thought that article was, it was the article that I thought was going to be hard. I had infinite confidence in you, but the article, I was like, this is hard. But like, I feel like you really did it. Like, I feel like you gave very convincing arguments and you, kind of stayed away from the parts where maybe there's like a lot of like strong conflict between Bitcoin and the left. But I even have thoughts about that, that like, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe actually, you know, like we can sort of like,
there are a lot of people who are Bitcoiners on the left. They just aren't as loud on Twitter.
Right. Yeah. Because they're not comfortable in that space.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. I found if there's something that I learned from writing this article, it's that actually we are much more bipartisan than we think we are. Mm. It's just that the red folks tend to be way louder. And there seems to be like kind of like a cool kid culture about like how red can you be on Twitter.
There's a lot of like Bitcoin kind of Christians.
Totally.
A lot of Bitcoin, like guns and outdoors stuff.
This is great.
I'm fine with this. But it's like, you're not going to go in there like, hey, like LGBTQ rights.
Well, what was really interesting is like, I know folks who like share my politics on the left around certain things. Like, you know, for instance, we talked a little bit about this tweet that I wrote, this like pro-choice tweet that I wrote. And I know that there are multiple folks who are like secretly pro-choice, but would never want to comment on a pro-choice tweet be in the Bitcoin space because they know they will get attacked in the Bitcoin space.
It's kind of mixed on that. Like surely not everybody on Twitter like is pro.
For sure. But there was a lot of the loudest voices were definitely who are arguing, which I was kind of surprised by because I always thought like libertarianism was about like, okay, freedom in all realms.
It's freedom, but then like, well, libertarians still think that murder is wrong.
Right. And like the definition of life.
Right. Yeah. And there is no clean definition of where life starts. Right.
What if the definition of life wasn't actually relevant though? Like if somebody is like attacking, I think it's irrelevant.
I think it's purely aesthetic.
If somebody comes into my home and is like not leaving, I have the right to forcibly remove them under libertarianism, right? Like under like a private property ideology means like I can forcibly remove
the
family.
So to be clear, I'm not like defending this viewpoint, but I have the least popular viewpoint of all, which is that abortion is like probably murder, and murdering people is okay sometimes. Sometimes you murder people for the greater good, and it's all good. So I have the worst opinion.
But
not to defend these positions, but it's like these are things about which reasonable people will disagree.
Sure.
Different people will disagree when life starts. different people will disagree whether the baby is a trespasser,
okay,
right? Or the baby is not a trespasser.
That's perhaps, where I got hung up.
Perhaps so, the baby has a special status different from the trespasser.
I tried to make the argument that the baby was a trespasser.
Seen this argument on libertarian forums. They go, oh, the baby is a trespasser. No, like, shoot your
it
fucking
is. It's
womb.
Like, I don't consent very to this person small being caliber inside bullet. Me. This is non-consensual. But right. Then what people fought me back against, what they said was like, you made this choice.
Yeah, if you invite somebody into your home
through the act of sex. And I'm like, so are we suggesting that if somebody doesn't want to have children, they should be celibate? Like, no, the I mean, only it's, way it's, to it's fully just, protect but, it, you know.
But here's the thing about these arguments is that's why I think moral arguments are essentially just worthless. Because yeah. it's just like, oh, is it murder? Is it not? Well, different people are
going
to
So what argument? So we should do the harm reduction argument.
Yeah,
the harm reduction argument about like how people are going to have abortions, whether you make it legal or not.
They're just
gonna
be
like,
unsafe,
they're just
going to
be
right?
more, like, more you know, like, people are going to die.
Yeah,
right.
like for example, like same thing with war on drugs. Like if you're talking yes. about is it moral or immoral to do drugs,
right.
That's like kind of a not useful stance. People will go
totally.
About it. But if you're like, okay, well, yeah, harm reduction. Massive spending on like prisons, like low quality drugs, like
right.
et cetera, et cetera. These are kind of arguments. They're practical arguments that people who feel both ways about the moral underlying black and white issue mm-hmm. can be swayed by. They can go, well, look, listen, I think abortion is murder, but listen, if you look at like, when I see statistics for
right. more
you know,
people are going to die
yeah,
if
yeah.
abortion is yeah. illegal than they will if it is legal by virtue of just like unsafe procedures.
Right, right. I think those arguments are just more persuasive.
Right.
But other arguments is like, yeah, it's like people on libertarian forums, they're going to have these like wild ass like disagreements just based on like
right.
black and white sort of moral judgments that are very idiosyncratic to the individual.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of funny like going from, I'm now sort of back on Twitter in some way because I'm like the dark shadowy figure behind Hell Money Podcast Twitter account.
That's right, yeah.
And so I got thrust.
Hell Money Pod on Twitter.
Yeah, find us on Twitter.
Come, we need to shitpost more regularly. I think we need to shitpost daily on
okay.
the Hell Money Pod.
We can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can try.
Goals.
Well, I refrained from shitposting earlier today because it's been an experience to get onto Bitcoin Twitter. I have not seen...
I didn't know that you took the plunge.
Well, I've been lurking.
Yeah,
been
we
lurking
both control the Hell Money Pod Twitter account.
Oh,
yeah.
I see.
So I have some adult supervision.
That's what I'm doing.
Got it. Okay.
But I am on Bitcoin Twitter now and have been for the past couple
have
days.
Have you been following... How have you decided who to follow?
Just followed people that either follow us or that I know personally so far.
Okay.
But, I mean, Twitter knows that I want Bitcoin Twitter now, so the feed is like... What about this? This person mm-hmm. like this thing, you know,
right.
I'm
right.
into Bitcoin Twitter now. And like, I have not seen so many like boomer Facebook meme formats. Like I was reintroduced to meme formats that I haven't seen in at least 5 years.
Like what?
Like,
are we boomers? Or
it was like,
or no,
it's not you guys.
How,
it's like,
are we the same age?
I'm like a smidge younger than you. I'm
okay, so
sure.
we're
millennials.
We're millennials.
Older
yeah,
millennials.
Yeah. Millennials are getting old.
I know.
Shit, millennials are almost middle age. This is bad.
We are also on the higher end of millennial. I think.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah
the
yeah,
upper
yeah.
end.
We're on the
we're luxury.
You're like almost Gen X over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hung out with Gen Xers in high school.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay.
My mom's a Gen Xer.
Bro. Listen, I'm
wow.
just going to jump out of the suicide.
Wow. Wow.
But no,
burn.
I mean like the type of memes okay. where it's like bottom, like top text, bottom text, and then like a real, like.
Listen, Bitcoin Twitter is not about subtlety. It's
like,
not
no.
about nuance.
No.
It's
no.
Social
it's
media
is
totally
not about
different
nuance.
World. It's not even like Pepe's though. Like I feel like crypto Twitter has like a little bit more of like the young 4chan-y kind of flair to it, but Bitcoin
they're less
Twitter,
angry.
Like,
yeah.
It feels
less
like adults.
Angry.
Like it feels like old men.
Yeah.
Like it has this like boomer vibe that I'm like, whoa, okay. These old farts like.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, the thing is that all of the Zoomers, they're all in, you know, circle jerking on Ethereum,
yeah.
right? That's what they're doing. That's where all of the young memers are being
it's
stolen.
Like
so we get the second tier memes.
It's like young optimistic technologists, right? Versus like pissed off people who like feel like they've been truly screwed by the government
right.
financially.
Yeah.
It's totally different motivations, you know,
yeah.
from one to the other.
It's also all of like a lot of the fun degens are on like DeFi. right? Like a lot of the people who are like, oh yeah, I'm just like on the internet all day, like trading shit coins. Yeah, like they're in DeFi land. They're not making Bitcoin memes.
Exactly. That's what I was expecting. Get them making the Bitcoin memes. I was expecting more of like the degenerates that are like in crypto world in general. Oddly enough,
Bitcoin used to be degenerate. Right? Bitcoin used to be like, it's crazy volatility. It's much less established. Everything is like a wild west. Now it's like much less volatility. Like among the crypto, among cryptocurrencies, it's like staid and like stable and safe.
Crypto people think that Bitcoin is boring.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is good. We kind of want Bitcoin to become boring.
Bitcoin is kind of the boomer coin.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, we've had this conversation before, like, it's making me, I feel like part of like Bitcoin's kind of different culture from the rest of crypto is kind of, it's like red right wing branding where it's like, it is just like attracting people that are like more right wing and are like, this is a thing. Like, I can use this.
We need to get the left on board.
We really need to. This is my mission.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, I mean, maybe this is jumping ahead, but talking about, one of the criticisms you talked about, well, not everybody on the left is a big government interventionist leftist. There is the tradition of sort of...
I mean, most voters don't even really necessarily fully understand that like the leftist tends to be more big government. But I think even at like sort of like higher levels of like people who are kind of more politically theoretical aware, theory aware.
Yeah. There is like the anarchist left.
Yes.
Libertarian, the word libertarian used to mean what we now call left libertarian. So there actually is like a left libertarian tradition.
So can you explain what that means? Because when I understand the left and the right, like I immediately think of like a spectrum from like Marxism to libertarianism, which is, I think, often how people think about it. So like, could we explain what it would mean to be like a left leaning?
Well, let's go to the beginning of the Russian Revolution.
Okay.
So, we've got all these like Ruskies, you know, they're like revolting.
Okay.
Right. And so you had the like Bolsheviks who were like the Marxists, you know, we're going to have like a big communist state that's all going to be like top down.
Like authoritarian
Marxism. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not democratic socialism.
Yeah.
Not AOC style.
No, but I mean, democratic socialism is also like a big government thing. They're like, that's true. We're going to have, you know, it's all like that because, you know, it is a big government thing. The USSR was nominally democratic, right? It was democracy all the way up, hypothetically, right? You had these like workers.
It was democratic.
Yeah, it was. Like, I mean, a Soviet is a group of people who vote on like an issue and who often will elect a representative to like a higher level Soviet, to a higher level Soviet side. Yeah. So the USSR was all like representative democracy, like a Matryoshka doll all down. But it was like you would send somebody up to the top and then they would make decisions on a top-down basis.
Okay, so not different. Not that different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but then, okay, so, but back to the Russian Revolution, we got the Bolsheviks, right? And then you also have all these, like, sort of anarchist leftists.
Okay.
Who are, like, they're into things like mutualism, like mutual aid, and, like, not having, like, top-down authority, like having, like, bottom-up, like, communes. Syndicalism. I mean, some things were like, no, we're going to have like unions and like all the individual unions for different industries are sort of going to do their thing. And there's not going to be like top-down control.
So like, it has to do with the bottom. Is it basically communalism from the bottom up versus the top down? Is
exactly.
that how you would describe?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Anarcho-leftism?
Yeah. Okay. What's it called? Anarcho-communism is kind of weird, but like, yeah, the sort of like bottom up thing. I think anarcho-communism is a little incoherent, but that's just me. That's fine.
Okay. Anyways. I think I'm an anarcho-communist.
Okay.
I have a lot of questions about the concept of mutual aid and how functionally it actually works.
But back to the Russian Revolution.
Okay.
And then all of the Marxists, the Bolsheviks, murdered everybody else, threw them out of power, like obliterated them. And that's what happens then and now. So the sort of non-big government left, they just don't really have a lot of political representation on the left, right? Like, they're not the people who are going to become politicians and, like, seize the reins of
power.
Because
they weren't participating in the system by definition.
Yeah, they don't want the system. They don't want the system to participate in. So it tends to be...
So they kind of got... They get taken over by the people who are able to organize at the top level, essentially.
Right. People who want to play the political game.
They effectively get oppressed.
Yeah, yeah, they get oppressed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, by the AOCs in the world who are like people who want to be like, oh, we're going to.
Just the largest governing organization. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, right. So the biggest organization is always going to win.
Right, right. So I think that like that Bitcoin is maybe that like these sort of like anarcho-communist types and like more decentralized types, they're probably a bit more sympathetic to Bitcoin, maybe, because it doesn't necessarily conflict so directly with their like big government. With like a big government.
Bitcoin doesn't conflict with any kind of big government. I mean, Bitcoin by definition is like resisting government control, right? So,
but I mean, it conflicts if you want a big government. In some ways, it can conflict with.
Oh,
it.
Sure, because you
can't necessarily do like the economic policies that.
Yes. The government can't control the currency by definition. Right. Whoa. Yeah. Exactly. So Bitcoin is great if you're into bottom up communal tribalism type structures.
So those people were the ones who were like, hey, like not every leftist is like a big government leftist. And they
like we're still into sharing. Right, we're just into like bottom up sharing versus top down sharing, which makes sense to me, except for the fact that I have like I don't know if this is like my bias or what's coming up for me right now, but when people talk about mutual aid, and I know we've had this conversation, mm-hmm. like I immediately am like, is that practical? Like what happens? Doesn't that mean that like in order to get your needs met, you by definition have to have social capital, which is not a guarantee in life?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how true this is, but I've heard that there used to be a lot more mutual aid before the government started doing more and more, you know, like St. Thomas's, you know, asylum for albino hemophiliacs, which is just run by like, you know, like charity and stuff. Right. Charities like so. And then the government started doing more social welfare stuff, sort of squeezed out those kinds of organizations. And like maybe they were pretty effective. I don't know that like when people are doing things,
the government squeezed them out, or people stopped doing those things because the government was doing it for them.
I say squeezed out, but I mean the latter. It's like if you're like, okay, well, there's Social Security, so now old people are getting payments. Maybe people are going to be less interested in forming mutual aid for the elderly, doing mutual aid for the elderly, right? Because they're like, oh, the government's taking care of that.
Even though it might be like a lesser solution,
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a better solution just because people allow it to happen over a different solution.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I have the same skepticism as you do, honestly.
I'm like concerned that mutual aid is like a recipe for like, you know, people who don't have social capital to just like get completely squeezed out. And like, you know, more marginalized folks are always going to fall into that category.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's a nice idea. Like, I feel like it relies on like having more of like a community network around you. And I like that idea of like, I feel like part of what like our current political system has created is like a lot of isolation and autonomy where people don't rely on the people near to them. They don't like have relationships with like their neighbors or the people in their community. And like, maybe it is like a utopian pipe dream to think that like that could be reformed, but I feel like I would love for that to be reformed. And to me, like, I think the idea of mutual aid is sort of like predicated on that as like the baseline, like foundation of it is that you have to have a relationship with your community. Your community has to have like some sort of network to like support each other. And I'm like, that's cute. Love that.
Well, it's sort of like ask this question of like, why do we have lesser community now? And why are we more isolated than we used to be? And it's funny because I always kind of thought that a big part of the answer to that question was just technology, right? Mm.
I think it's the government.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, but I view everything as like it's all the government's fault. I'm like, yeah, I mean, okay. Like you have this.
Tell me more about
this. Like nanny state that you're like, oh, it's taking care of all of our needs. Like it's the ultimate like backstop of society. Like, oh, I don't need to do anything. I just once a year I go vote. I don't need to participate in my community. I don't need to do anything. The state is going to like make projects go away. Everybody looks to the state to solve things. Right. And so nothing gets done. Nothing gets fixed because the state is, you know, ultimately totally incompetent.
But we've had like destruction of neighborhood and communities that's been like on like exponentially just getting squashed into oblivion, even in just the past like 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. Like that feels to me like a direct result of, you know, things like social media and people like just being addicted to screens.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like partially because everybody has like email jobs now. Like they don't like go and like go to the store and do whatever things in person. They just kind of like...
They don't pump milk out of the ground with an oil derrick or whatever they did back
the good old days.
Yeah, people don't meet each other in bars or coffee shops anymore because they've got their headphones in and they're on their phones.
Right. See, now we're the Facebook boomers.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I think it's like a combination of many factors, but I think it's been ultimately bad for us. Like, I feel like it's kind of like a, I don't know, it's like a sad, ironic, like, situation where we all have, like, all of our needs met. We all live, like, very comfortable lives, and yet, like, there's so much mental health, like, issues.
It's isolation. We're so isolated.
Exactly. So, like, I like the idea of mutual aid as, like, I just think that, like, when people need to, they do come together, and they often do support each other, and, like, in times of, like, crisis or natural disasters, like, that often seems to be in the case both in the U.S. and, like, around the world, and so... I don't know. Part of me is like, maybe that could help. Like, I don't know what else we do about it. Like, I think like the lack of community is such a huge problem, you know?
Yeah, totally. Like, I don't think
the government
like,
can mandate it either.
No.
Be like, you guys are friends now.
I know. Useless.
Casey has an opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so anything else that we want to talk about related to like the left? Related to Bitcoin and the left and why.
Oh, I was going to ask.
Hates the Bitcoin. Even though they really shouldn't, because Bitcoin really helps all people and people on the left should care about all people.
Bitcoin for the people. I was going to ask if you've had any success orange pilling your friends and family. Mm. Like, have you actually successfully converted
people?
I have
very effectively orange pilled my dad.
Oh, yeah. What's your strategy?
Just sending him Michael Saylor videos.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Wait, yeah. And your dad was like a, was he like a hardcore leftist or like where
was
my
dad has like a political leaning that like really was varied throughout his life. Like I think he grew up in like a pretty conservative kind of like more like, I don't know, I guess. I mean, I don't even know where his family's at. This was also at a time, I think, like 50 years ago, there was less division. Like people would like vote for one party one year and then vote for another party the last year. Like I think we have to remember that, you know, decades ago, there was less of this like tribal division between parties where like you were like a Democrat for life or a Republican for life, you know, and there was just more opportunity for switching between depending on the candidate. But yeah, my dad, I mean, I know that when he was in his early 20s, he was, you know, like a Reaganomics, like Republican type with the, you know, he worked in advertising in New York and like wore his Gucci loafers. And then he took a job selling advertising for The Nation. Are you familiar with The Nation? It's a Green Party magazine.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And he like got kind of converted to Green Party.
Okay.
And then he was very green and had the sort of like this whole like hippie revelation. And then, you know, I think now he is certainly more democratically leaning and you know, he's, you know, 70 years old and watches a lot of MSNBC.
Uh-huh.
But I think he's been all over the map and he immediately like got it when I started sending him YouTube videos. I mean, we kind of got into it together. I mean, I immediately, once I was going through my learning journey, I brought him with me and he was really open to it. And that was really, that's been like a very special thing in our relationship, actually. I feel like my dad and I are like super tight because we bond about Bitcoin.
That's love cute.
I will say my mother, on the other hand, has been completely unopen to it.
Have you tried to?
I have tried. And she has a finance background, a very strong finance background. I feel like I made a really compelling case for why Bitcoin matters. And she's very resistant to it. But it also makes sense to me as a person who, like many people in their generation, is completely dependent on their equities portfolios, you know, to survive. You know, like most Americans in that generation are completely dependent on the stock market.
What's the sticking point for her?
She doesn't really have a strong argument against it. It's more just like a strong suspicion. And she also gets all of her information from like Morgan Stanley, right? Like she gets all of her information from like her asset managers, traditional finance asset managers, who see Bitcoin as like this super speculative, risky thing.
Right.
And she's not a person who at 70 years old is going to like go and like learn about how the protocol works and like really like dig into the security of it on her own. You know, like she trusts Morgan Stanley. More than she trusts me, you know?
I think that asset managers in particular, there is a huge gap of where asset managers are and where they should be. They all see Bitcoin as this like crazy speculative thing. They're very much entrenched in taking fees off of people, buying financial products, buying equities. They kind of want their clients to like, they want to actively manage their clients' wealth. They don't want to say like, oh yeah, like just take some money and put it in Bitcoin and forget it. like they're sort of incentivized the wrong direction.
Bitcoin is a fundamental threat to the U.S. financial system, right? Yeah. I mean, we have to remember that
Don't say that out loud.
Am I not allowed? But I think, like, you know, whenever I hear FUD, whenever I hear, like, sort of mainstream, you know, just sort of arguments against Bitcoin that, like, you and I would listen to and be like, that doesn't actually make a lot of sense when you, like, really learn about it. But, like, these sort of just, like, general, like, news arguments, I'm like, who is this coming from? Like, which top-down person is coming from? And I think about, you know, like, every politician in New York State, for instance. I mean, New York has had, you know, politicians who have swung really far back on both sides. Like, sometimes I think to myself, like, does Elizabeth Warren just have, like, you know, get a lot of money from, like, Goldman's, you know, not like Chase, you know, like, or JP Morgan, all of these companies? Because functionally speaking, Bitcoin, in a hyper Bitcoinized world, fractional reserve banking can't exist.
Okay.
And can it?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about that. Because I personally think that Bitcoin is, like, kind of, like, functionally threatening to this whole, like, debt-based, crazy domino.
So like, I think I agree with that. I think it's like, yeah, fractional reserve lending can't exist, right? Like,
you can't have, like, okay, I'm going to hold on the balance sheet. Like, I'm going to basically claim that, like, all the people who have deposited. What's happening right now in the banking system, as I understand it, and you should correct me if I'm wrong because I'm no expert, but my understanding is right. So a bunch of people deposit money into their banks, and the banks essentially say, like, yes, you have this, like, on your balance sheet effectively. Like, if you want to take out a deposit, you know, if you want to, you know, take money out from your account at any time, you can, and we'll give it to you. And it's FDIC insured, even though that's questionable and blah, blah, blah. But then, so it's sort of like, it's on one balance sheet there,
right.
But then they don't actually need to, and they're lending it to somebody else.
So
they kind of have, like, it's sort of like $2. For every $1 in real existence, there's actually $2 happening.
Right, the dollar that you owe to the depositor and the dollar that the, like, that you gave to the lender.
So there's, like, twice as many fake dollars happening on all the balance sheets rather than, like, what actually exists.
Right,
and
right.
That can't work on a Bitcoin network.
Well, it can. So, like, what the you know, sort of the money that
everyone would know what was going on.
Yeah, people would know what was going on, and also,
and it couldn't, like, domino forever and ever and ever into oblivion.
I mean, if we just sort of switched the banking system to everything being denominated in Bitcoin,
right?
They could do exactly the same thing as they do now, right? They have bank money, which is a sort of multiplied. They have bank the sort of multiplied money, you call that, like, bank money.
Right.
Bank money gets sort of created by, it gets, like, lent into existence, right? And that inflates the supply of bank money. Currently, bank money is denominated into US dollars, In a Bitcoin world, you could have all these banks engaging in fractional reserve lending, and bank money is denominated in Bitcoin, right? I get a Bitcoin deposit and I lend somebody out a Bitcoin.
Right.
But none of these people can actually take their money out of the bank money system, right? So it's...
No one can take it out now or the whole economy collapses.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, it's just whether or not fractional reserve banking is kind of orthogonal to whether there's hyper Bitcoinization or not.
You're going to have to tell me what orthogonal means.
We can have, what I mean, well, I guess the right way to say is independent. We can have a dollar denominated economy or Bitcoin denominated economy, and we can have fractional reserve banking or not fractional reserve banking in both cases, right? I think in a Bitcoin world, one nice thing is that if it's easy to get if you can just take your money out as Bitcoin,
right,
that makes it very easy for you not to participate in the fractional reserve system at all if you don't want to. Take your Bitcoin out, and then it's not
it's optional if you want to participate in this, like, lending schema. Whereas,
right
now, it is not optional. And that's a very huge distinction.
Because you need a bank account.
Right.
You need all these things. Yeah, and the Fed, like, or the regulators, they actually won't let us opt out of fractional reserve lending.
Yeah.
There was a bank called the Narrow Bank, which was, like, a startup, a financial services startup. And they were like, okay, we're going to have a bank, and we're just going to have deposits at the Fed. And so when you deposit $100 in our bank, we're just going to have that $100 deposit at the Fed bank. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to do any lending or anything. And regulators blocked it because they were like, we can't give I'm, like, exaggerating, but not that much. They were like, we can't give people a way of opting out into our ridiculous, inflated, bullshit fractional reserve system. We have to kill this. That's literally what happened.
Right. So circling back, this is a perfect loop back.
But the thing that we can't have is like the debt. Talk about like debt. Why no debt in a hyper Bitcoinized world?
I guess that right. But you'd have a lot of people opting out of participating in debt. So by definition, there would be significantly less debt because every single individual would have the opportunity to like choose whether or not they wanted to lend out their money. And that is not the way the world works today, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, even beyond, I think maybe I said this in the first episode, but going back to what you said about your mom and like, you know, your parents are like in their 70s and they're like retired and they're living off a 401k. I think like if you think about like a goal of the left being an anti-corporation goal as opposed to like whatever, anti-capitalism, anti-whatever, like anti these like corporations that control our lives, I think more than the US government does. I'm much more threatened by like the big corporations than the US government. Mm. Like so much of our power to resist those corporations is limited by the fact that every American has their savings for retirements in a 401k in stock in those companies.
Those same corporations also control the financial system and they make up all these like systemically important.
And they effectively control the government. They effectively control everything and we
too
can't resist
them.
Yeah, because if they fell, then all of our savings would fall. But
exactly.
In a Bitcoin world, you don't have to put all of your money in S&P 500
They're
stocks,
not inflating
right?
the money. And so just putting your Bitcoin under your mattress is a totally valid saving strategy
right.
in a way that it's not today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oof. That's one of my big orange pilling things I like to tell people on the left. Like if you hate corporations, then like you probably want a way of storing money that isn't just invested completely in the success of corporations in this country.
Right.
Which currently we have no other way of doing that.
Right. Which is also like, you know, even for just like hardcore straight up capitalists, like I think that that's important, right? I mean, like you would be the first to say that like we shouldn't be subsidizing these corporations the way that we are. Like that is
not
free market capitalism.
And like, it's not the norm that your money just like evaporates, right? Like it's not the norm that each one of us like, you know, like I'm a programmer, like I make money programming, right? I don't want to be a stock trader. I don't want to be like, oh, how do I invest my money so that it doesn't evaporate? That's not my specialty. I don't know anything about that.
Right.
I don't want to know anything about that.
Right.
And I shouldn't
Bitcoin
have
solves
to.
This.
Yeah. I just like put it in the orange coin and then I just sit on it and it's all good.
That is honestly like sort of like the revelation that I came to was like, this is just the easiest strategy for wealth preservation that's ever existed. And therefore, like, yes.
Yeah.
You know, like,
it's accessible to everyone and it's not dependent on like the success of corporation or investment or whatever thing that you're putting it into to keep up with inflation.
So accessibility is another really important word that I used in my article that I think, you know, people on the left should be into and excited about, right? Like right now, the biggest problem with wealth preservation is that like our greatest strategies for wealth preservation in the United States are really relegated to people who can afford entry, right? So like real estate, for instance, you know, who the hell can afford real estate in San Francisco? Like even like, you know, the top, like
you can't buy a fraction of a house.
You can't, right?
But you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin.
Yes. Right. Like, you know, you can buy $5 worth of Bitcoin, right? Like you cannot, you know, if you want to preserve your wealth via the real estate, you know, strategy, you're going to be have to be saving your pennies for quite a long time. Meanwhile, it's like inflating away while you save.
Yeah.
So I think that this is like a really big deal because I think, you know, most folks on the left, like, you know, claim to care about accessibility and equaling the playing field and like, you know, equal opportunity for people across classes.
Right.
This is a class neutral opportunity for folks to actually participate in wealth preservation. And quite frankly, like if they, you know, the other option is like Venezuela. I mean, like that's like where we're headed right now.
I like the way you think.
I know.
Orange coin or Venezuela.
Yeah.
Those are the two options. There is no middle ground.
It's true. Well, for a really long time, I was one of those people who thought that like my money was safe because I was always thinking about inflation and the strength of the dollar relative to other fiat currencies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it was like a total mind shift to remember that the strength of the dollar should not necessarily be denominated or valued relative to the strength of other fiat currencies. It should be relative to things like real estate. It should be relative to
sandwiches.
Yes.
How many sandwiches can you buy today? How many sandwiches can you buy tomorrow?
Exactly. Like the whole, I think most people are like living in a world where they like, you know, they value the dollar against other fiat currencies. They don't necessarily value, we haven't been really taught as a culture to value the dollar against actual cost of real things.
Right. It's because all the other currencies are so bad.
Yeah.
If you look at like, oh my God, like all the currencies currencies in like South America, Africa, most of Asia, Eastern Europe, like they're just bad. Like double digit inflation is the norm. Like we hit 10% inflation. We're freaking out. These currencies are like 20% year over year for like 100 years. Like those countries are just in a consistent state of getting wrecked, just continually wrecked.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so terrible. That's why they love stable coins.
They love stable coins. They love the dollar. Yeah. They love stable coin dollar. Because they're just trading in these like pesos, like these like awful pesos.
Right. People, I know, I remember like there was like hearing about like all the politicians concerned about, you know, I guess like folks in Russia like getting after Bitcoin or whatever. It's like, no, they probably want stable coins.
Mm, yeah. But they'll want, look.
They'll want Bitcoin too.
Bitcoin is getting close to being a stable coin.
Bitcoin.
30K. Like. Yeah. Yeah. Look at me. I'm the stable coin now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. At what price point do you think Bitcoin would have to get in order to like really be like quote unquote non-volatile? Like at what?
I have no idea because like I've heard arguments that like I was like, oh, like, well, I guess as the
depends
market
on the
cap,
inflation of the dollar. It depends on how bad the dollar gets out of control, I guess.
Well, no, but at a certain point, if Bitcoin got good enough and the dollar got crazy enough, even though the Bitcoin would be very volatile in dollar terms because the dollar was inflating.
Right.
Up and down and doing crazy shit.
I mean, it would be going up really fast. Yeah. Situation.
It would still be stable in purchasing power terms, in like sandwich terms, right?
Right.
You would still be able to buy the same number of sandwiches tomorrow as you did today, but the menu sandwich pricing in dollars would be going crazy.
I guess there's no specific price that we can wait for. I guess you could think about like market cap, like at a certain point of a certain percentage of the world is using Bitcoin, then it's like, okay, this is probably the level where Bitcoin's going to be relatively stable in purchasing power terms.
Right. Yeah.
Not in dollar terms.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I thought is like, oh, as the market cap goes up, then at a certain point, volatility must go down. Because it takes more like buys and sells to move the market price at a very high market cap.
Right.
However, like gold has had 10x the market cap of Bitcoin and gold is pretty volatile. So.
I think Bitcoin's going to be gold.
Oh yeah. Bitcoin's going to trounce gold.
Yeah.
So that means that there's like a 20x.
We've got 20x in our lifetime.
Upside.
Yeah.
In that back pocket right there.
I do think, I feel like the type of people who are into Bitcoin for like the potential gains and are like, Bitcoin's going to hit 1 million or 10 million in like 10 years. Like, just you wait.
It will.
I'm like,
it will.
I'm like, yeah, it probably will. But like, look out your window at what America looks like if Bitcoin hits 10 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to be a pretty path. No. Like $1 million Bitcoin. Like $1 million Bitcoin means like some shit went down.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a lot of other,
and that's why I'm like, okay, you better be doomsday prepping in other way. Like, you know, that's my constant critique of Bitcoiners.
Not enough doomsday prepping.
Yeah. But maybe that's what I have in common with like the gun people on Twitter because they're doing their version of doomsday prepping.
Right.
It's just not like cottage core.
They don't have enough chickens.
Yeah.
Their ratio of chickens to guns is
the primary doomsday prep that they would need to do is literally just start buying Bitcoin because like we're talking about financial apocalypse, right?
So,
like,
Yeah.
Bitcoin is the doomsday prep for financial apocalypse.
It is true. Like, I definitely agree. I think though, like, you know, the societal conditions in which you're living in, like, will necessitate some level of like survivalist if shit got really, really bad. $10 million Bitcoin bad.
Yeah.
You know
When Bitcoin stablecoin thing, I'll tell you exactly how it's going to go.
Okay.
So there's this thing called Taro, which lets you have assets on Bitcoin and also lets you have stablecoin denominated Lightning Network channels.
Taro.
T-A-R-O. Okay. It was like,
not to be confused with Terra.
I mean, but not to be confused with Terra. No.
Okay.
So there's this Taro thing. It's like kind of new. All the stablecoin issuers want this because the stablecoin issuers, they're just out here like shilling stablecoins and they're out here like on Tron and like Binance Smart Chain, these dog poot doo doo tier, like smart contract chains that have very high transaction rates and low fees. We haven't decided if we're giving up.
You can say shit, damn, and hell.
Oh, YouTube. Really? Okay, fine. Yeah. They're out here on these dog shit tier chains. All right. Like sucking CZ's dick. Like
no, I don't think you can say that.
Okay. Back it up. So anyways, so stablecoins have migrated to these like just bottom of the barrel chains because they want low fees and fast transactions. And they were on Bitcoin, then they went to Ethereum, but then Ethereum got very expensive, and then they went to these like fourth tier chains. The stablecoin issuers don't really want to be on those chains. The stablecoin issuers would much rather be on Bitcoin because they don't have anything to do with like smart contracts. They're just like people who want to like move like dollars around, like these like digital like dollar IOUs. So now there's Taro by Lightning Labs. Taro will, I think, become popular, and we'll start to see stablecoin issuers kind of go back to Bitcoin by issuing them on Taro. And then you can actually route these stablecoin payments through the Lightning Network so that like on you have a stablecoin channel like into the main chain Lightning Network, and then the recipient also has a stablecoin channel into the Bitcoin Lightning Network. You send stablecoin dollars along this Lightning channel. They get translated into Bitcoin to like bounce around the Lightning Network, and then they get exchanged out at the other end. So you sent US dollars, your recipient received US dollars, stablecoin US dollars.
This is like what Strike is doing. There's like payment processors who are doing effectively that. I mean, they're different, but
yeah.
But like it's like immediate conversion like into and out of the Bitcoin network from dollars into Bitcoin and back into dollars in like an immediate way.
Yeah. And so this is probably that's
for lower fees than credit card companies would charge.
Yeah.
Hence, if you're a small business, this is something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think this is what's going to happen is like stablecoins on Taro. Stablecoins migrate to essentially use like Bitcoin and the Lightning Network as like this like liquidity payment network. Stablecoins start getting very low fees, very fast transaction rates. Everybody is sort of already on the Lightning Network anyways because they're using these stablecoins in Lightning Network. And then the dollar continues to like crash and burn. Bitcoin continues to go up, get more stable. They're already on the Lightning Network anyways. It's not such of a jump to start being like Bitcoin native on the Lightning Network. That's our like exit strategy and like how we get to like $10 million Bitcoin.
Wow. You got it all figured out.
Yeah.
How long does this take in decade terms?
I don't know. Like maybe a decade.
From now?
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Wow.
Called it here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
$10 million Bitcoin in 10 years.
Yeah, you heard it from me. I'll eat John McAfee's dick. Gonna dig him up.
Maybe that's the best way to sell it to
Oh, right. I can't say. No. Yeah, okay. No. Yeah,
we've unleashed
I'll
you
eat
now.
I'll John McAfee's pee-pee.
No.
I mean, we did do like... Yeah. I mean, yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, good theory. I hope you're right.
Yeah, we'll see.
I think a lot of people on the left say that they're like, oh, this is just another way for rich people to get rich, right? That's another like criticism. Like they're like, oh, this is just going to end up fucking people over because there's going to be this like redistribution of wealth. And then like whoever has Bitcoin is just going to be the new class of wealthy people. And I'm like, yeah, but like people can get in on it now. Like, go now. Like, you know, I'm kind of like, is that really an argument? If like right now, retail, this is one of the most amazing things about Bitcoin is that it's the first asset class that actually preferences and is actually giving benefit to retail investors over institutions. Retail investors can actually get in before institutions. Institutions are having trouble getting in. You can actually beat the institutions to it if you get in now.
Yeah.
Like the regular normal people. This is a miracle. Yeah. This has never happened before.
And not just like on two fronts, right? One is that the institutions are super cautious and risk averse.
Right. Because they only care about quarterly. They're not long-term thinkers.
Right.
Yeah.
And then two, all the institutions are, they have like weird regulatory things. Oh, they can't even hold Bitcoin.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like how do they even custody it? Mm-hmm. It like involves like infrastructural like challenges.
Right. They don't know what a private key is.
Yeah. They don't know what a private key is. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it's like, it's a little bit of like hypocrisy for people on the left, because I think on the one hand, and there's this idea on the left that like everything has to come from the people, like we should do what's like good for the people, whatever. But then when you make that into an individual person making a decision to buy Bitcoin or something, they're like, no, that can't happen. We can't have everyone buy Bitcoin. That's not a good solution. It's like, well, what?
It's almost like they're like committed. It's almost like they're like committed to like maintaining the like oppression happening, you know, like maintaining the like
the
world.
Left is full of losers.
Right.
They love to lose.
Like committed to like self-victimization, you know?
And I mean, it is like what I said before about just like, I think there's a lot of people on the left who don't believe in any economic solution. Like it will not matter what you present to them. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to hear that they need to do something. They need to buy this or tell people to buy this or promote something. They're like, no, all money is evil.
Yeah.
Right. I'm committed. Right. They're committed to no solution. They're committed to just like continued no solution.
Just like self-flagellation as like a party like platform. Just like till the end of time.
Yeah. I honestly think that was like a big part of like my awakening to Bitcoin too was like.
Although just, I guess that's not true actually, because I guess they do have the whole, you know, they thought Bernie was the solution. They like to some extent.
Yeah, but
they
that is like pew. You right, know, right. There's like nothing there. I mean like. that ship has sailed. That's all we had, and it
but like I don't know, is it really fair to say that they don't think that there was a solution? I mean, let's just back up. I know I interrupted you, so I apologize, but like, you know, I mean, maybe
it's like there are a lot of
they
solutions,
seem to think that like government redistribution of wealth is the solution. The problem is that there's literally like no historical examples of that going well. That's right. Really where that my article eventually landed was like, okay, let's look at like redistribution of wealth by central governing bodies as like a as just like a historical, you know, like phenomenon, and like how has it gone? We don't have like a single reference point of that, like
Holodomor round two. We don't want that, you know.
Right. So anyway, and
No. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it is just a little bit of like an aversion. Well, I think that criticism of like government versus a government solution, a top down solution versus like a bottom up solution is like a big part of it. That like. Some people just can't get past. They just want it to be done from the top down. They don't want to have to like participate it on an individual level or frankly like believe in it really. They can just outsource that to somebody else to solve that problem and like hope that it happens.
Well, because bottom up historically has had an organizational problem, right? Yeah. Like how do you organize like a bunch of like smaller communities is a problem.
Well,
right?
The answer to that question is one that the left really doesn't like.
What?
Capitalism and markets. Right? Capitalism and markets is the big coordination mechanism that allows a lot of independent people
to organize,
to interact via the market. They go, oh, like widgets, you can make a lot of money selling widgets.
Right.
I'm going to make some widgets because I see that I can make a lot of money. Nobody had to tell me to make widgets, right? Everybody just kind of organizes.
But the reason they don't like that is because then certain people, by definition, we've talked about this
they're
going to be winners and losers.
And capitalism is now kind of like definitionally bad, right? When you say capitalism to some people on the left they think, oh, like that's a bad thing,
right? But like, I mean, because of the winners and losers thing, though, it's like, how do you solve that? And I guess the only answer that I have heard is mutual aid. And then that, again, it just makes me kind of like scratch my head with skepticism.
Maybe like UBI, you know?
I mean, like, isn't that anti-capitalist kind of like by definition?
But I mean, like,
isn't UBI like the ultimate like top down?
So UBI is, I mean, like. Okay, like I'm not, I want the government to kind of go away. They can all just die in a fire. That would be fine, like me.
But I feel like we can't say that on YouTube.
You want politicians to die in a fire? It's not an individual, I don't want any individual politician to die in a fire. I just want all of them together to die in a fire.
He's individual.
Right? Or
this is philosophical.
Politicians are definitely not a protected class. Like, no way. They're not one of the people who you can't talk smack about. So anyways, but if we are going to have some kind of government intervention, let's say we have unfettered capitalism and we're like, the people who are winning too much and the people who are like losing really bad. They're impoverished out here just trying to get a scrap of widgets and the big capitalists are a huge pile of widgets, you know, and we don't like that, right? Okay, so if we are going to have some kind of government intervention, we want the kind of government intervention that does the least bad, that has the least harmful effect on the economy.
Okay, and so you're a moderate, Casey.
I don't believe this. If I wanted any government,
it would be tiny government.
And also like the government, which it kind of messes things up the least.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So, I would want a government that collected taxes in some very efficient and non-disruptive way.
Okay.
Probably a land value tax.
Right.
Our good friend Henry George and Georgism, our guy. A land value tax is a tax on the unimproved value of land, and it's a very efficient tax that has a lot of economically appealing properties. Mm. And then what do they do with that money? I would say just divide it by the number of people in the country and give it out to individuals. The problem now is that what the government does is it collects all these taxes in all these bad ways, and then it does a lot of harmful things with them. It just buys random things. It says, oh, you have to spend your money on, we're going to tell you what you spend your money on. We're going to give you food stamps. The formula shortage was caused in parts by the fact that states are massive purchasers of infant formula.
Really?
Yeah, which tends to consolidate the markets. So like,
why is that?
Because the states.
Why were they purchasing the baby formula in the begin with?
Because there are lots of programs of like maternal assistance, and so then the states are like, okay, now all of Iowa is buying formula from one manufacturer, right? Because it's the state doing this purchase for this massive program. I'm like, no, let's not do that. Instead of buying a dollar worth of formula and giving it to a mother, let's give the mother a dollar. The mother can go buy whatever formula she wants, or maybe not formula if that's not the most valuable thing.
Right.
We don't have weird government distortion of markets.
Right.
So I think, yeah, like a good tax and like a good, like the least harmful tax and the least harmful wealth redistribution.
Right.
If I was a filthy communist, that's what that's what I would want.
Totally.
Yeah.
You've really got it all figured out, huh?
Yeah. No, I don't know. But actually, no, but I thought about this.
I mean, like, I think that that sounds like the most reasonable way to handle, like, what I still consider to be, like, the not-so-sure way that mutual aid could work.
Right.
Like, well, yeah.
So I thought about this from the perspective of, like, okay, well, like people on the left, people like large government, they clearly want things that I don't want. And they have this like underlying like beliefs that I don't share, like the efficiency of government and whatever. But so what would be the option that would be the most appealing to people that would be sort of like the least bad? And so I thought of it from that sort of point of view. It's like, okay, well, what can I say that we should do? Like instead of saying like, hey, come join me and be an ANCAP and let's like, just like let capitalism rip, like let's go. That's not going to work. So then I could say like, hey, maybe you should do this thing that's like just less bad on all axes than the thing that you're doing.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like your own harm reduction.
Yeah, harm reduction. Yeah. Leftists out here shooting up like heroin, dying from like fentanyl overdoses by the million. I'm like, let's just go get high and smoke some weed. It's no big deal.
Speaking of UBI, should we talk about Arika Rhodes? Should we talk about the congresswoman who ran for Congress who is running on a pro-Bitcoin, pro-UBI platform?
Oh, nice, nice.
I don't
know anything about this. Can you give us the backstory?
I mean, I don't really know that too much about that either.
Good. Other than the blind leading the blind.
But, you know, it was interesting. You know, there was a bipartisan Bitcoin lecture happening in Bitcoin Miami, and Aaron and I went, and there was like a panelist of different, you know, people involved in politics who are pro-Bitcoin. And this particular candidate was running for Democratic Congress. I don't know if she won or if
it hasn't happened.
Primary.
Yet. The primary hasn't happened.
Oh, the primary hasn't happened. Yeah. But they were run. This person, Arika, is running on both a pro UBI, pro Bitcoin platform, which again sort of felt like the most intense version of like what we're talking about. The sort of like combination of like libertarianism, Bitcoin, and like ultimate, what feels like ultimate, you know, kind of socialist Marxism. UBI feels like more of like this socialist idea, right?
Well, it's like let's say we have a big government that's like taxing $1 million and spending $1 million. Like, well, like libertarians might argue that like they should tax less and spend less. But if they're going to tax and spend, like let's have them not do it in the worst way possible, right?
Yeah.
Which is where UBI comes in.
Makes sense. Totally.
Yeah. Vote Arika Rhodes if you live in the Valley or something.
Is that where she is? Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Somebody who you dislike, who is my BFF, was really into UBI.
Who?
Milton Friedman. Yeah.
Oh, my plot twist.
Yeah, Milton Friedman argued. He argued for a negative income tax, where if you earned a certain amount of money, not only would you not pay any taxes, you would get money back on your tax return every year.
If you made a certain amount of money.
No, if you earned below a certain amount of money. So it was like pay taxes, but get a refund. Yeah.
But wouldn't, you know, all the like, you know, conservatives in the US would say, but like that just incentivizes people to sit on their couch and not do anything. Isn't that like
that's the smooth brain conservative take. That's the smooth brain conservative take. Oh, it's going to incentivize people, blah, blah, blah. The like many brain folds conservative take is like, well, not having any,
the smooth brain is a neg.
The smooth brain is a neg.
Smooth brain. You don't want to be smooth brain.
You want lots of groups. Koalas are smooth brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like if you take eucalyptus leaves off of a tree, they won't recognize it. It has to be attached to a branch, and we hypothesize that it's because their brains are very smooth. So, like, the
not a lot going on.
Yeah,
no complexity.
So, like, small brain meme is like, oh, like that's bad. It's going to encourage people not to work. The like galaxy brain take is okay. Well, the thing that I want, which is no government, is not on the table. I have to negotiate with people who believe differently than me, and UBI is way less harmful. If the government is going to tax $10 and spend $10, spent just giving it to people as money is way less harmful than whatever.
And these programs and all this stuff that's going on. I mean, I was really surprised to know just how inefficient the government was. I mean, this was like another part of my personal journey. This was another part of my personal journey where I started to question my beliefs and started to question everything that I think I know. Was when I realized that it was something that's like 1 in 10 people in the United States is employed by the government.
Right.
So a big, the huge percentage of taxes. I mean, there's obviously like the military and stuff and all the obvious things that people complain about. But like these other things is like, you know, a lot of our tax dollars are spent to just employ a very specific voting bloc and just keep, they just don't want to fire their voters.
Right.
Which to me, that was like.
Yeah. And sort of definitionally, those people are not doing something useful. Like,
yeah,
they might be doing something, producing something.
It's like really bad tenured professors or something.
Right. And then just the scale of the inefficiency is like wild. Like, for example, navies, their submarines, they had these like fancy like control consoles for their like, you know, periscope that was like cost like $75,000. And then they replaced it with an Xbox controller that cost $10 and was better and it was easier to train people on. Like that's the scale is that like when you channel $1,000 through the government, it's not like you get like $90, like $1,000 of government. It's not like you get $900 of benefit. It's like you get $9 of benefit.
It's like really inefficient. It's like bleeding to death inefficient.
Yeah. Real bad. Yeah.
Getting anti-government pilled over here.
That's been the direction that it's been going for me lately, which is interesting because, I mean, for me, for so long, and I think a lot of people feel this way, you know, it just sort of felt like, again, it's just this sort of very traditional idea of like Democrats versus Republicans. And there's like certain things that define Democrats and certain things that define Republicans. And one of the things that Democrats sort of want is like, they want to like do more programs and like more spending. And like, that's, you know, it's all redistribution of wealth and all of the things, but this is functionally what it involves. And Republicans want less of that. And they want, you know, less taxes and less programs, which the left thinks is screwing people over, and this whole back and forth, right? I think that that's like the primary narrative that we hear about this left-right dichotomy in the U.S. And and I was always on the left side of that argument, and now I'm like, oh, this actually makes no sense. And the currency debasement piece really hit it home for me. Like, that's when I was like, oh, we're all getting screwed by this system because these dollars, it's not just taxes. It's not just the taxes they tell you about. It's also the taxes that they take from under your nose that you don't even realize it's happening. Yeah. And that is currency debasement. That's what currency debasement is.
Very strong, like, don't tread on me vibes coming.
Yeah. I have been killed.
No step on snake, baby. Yeah.
I watch a lot of Michael Saylor. Yeah. Me and my dad, we watch videos. When I was in the Catskills 2 weeks ago, me and my dad just watched Bitcoin documentaries on Netflix and Amazon Prime. Nice. Like every night we would do a new one.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's so cute.
It was cute. I recommend bonding about Bitcoin with your family. It's a good
orange pill your family.
Yeah. Or it could also not go well, which is how it went with my mother. It has not gone well. And it actively makes her feel threatened to the point where she's like, I don't want to talk about this with you because she feels like I'm like talking down to her, like telling her what to do or something. Yeah. And I think it scares her because the idea that the stock market is being propped up by like effectively like government subsidies that, you know, are, you know, really on shaky ground scares the shit out of her.
I think I know what you can do.
What?
For your mom. Get your mom on board.
Okay.
You go, okay, I bought you, we never have to talk about it again.
Okay.
But I bought you a tenth of a Bitcoin. Oh. And I'm just going to hold on onto it for you. So tenth of a Bitcoin. If you go look at the Bitcoin price and divide it by 10, that's how much Bitcoin you have.
So I actually one-upped this idea. Uh-huh. I actually did an even better. I bought her husband some Bitcoin for Christmas.
Oh, wow.
And I sent her husband some Bitcoin for Christmas. And I just like kind of had to be like, oh, isn't this like a fun techie thing? I'm like getting your husband this like man present. And who knows, maybe that Bitcoin will
I think you also want to get her a little bit. Get that. Everybody's got a little degen inside with like, ooh, number go up. Like I like
Well, right now a number is definitely gone down.
No, but that's why you do it now, not
right,
if you
do
did
it now.
If you
do
did it,
it
a couple months ago, it would have been a disaster.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure my mom is like, oh, Isabel, my dad is a full hodler now. But I'm sure my mom is like, you know, telling her husband, yeah, I told Isabel that this Bitcoin thing wasn't going to work. Look, we're down 40%, right, you know, since I bought the Christmas Bitcoin.
It's actually really good though, because I mean, if she's aware of the price now, when it goes to like 100K, right, she'll be like, oh, it's kind of up now.
Yeah, it's kind of up.
And then
now,
when it goes down to like 90K, in her mind, it'll still be up, right? It's like you get this like the sort of the price of Bitcoin gets fixed at some previous price. And anytime it's above that, from then on, you kind of think of it as being up.
Right, from whatever your buy price was. This is why they talk about like the Bitcoin classes. Like, are you class of 2017? Mm-hmm. Are you class of 2013? Like, work? I mean, I don't know about you. I'm class of 2021, so yeah. I'm pledging right now. You know what I mean? Fully, like, you know, in it and, like, showing my worth and, like, demonstrating that I am earning it. But, you know, if you're class of 2013, 2017, like, you're not even noticing what's going on right now in the markets. Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, I'm like, you know, literally like 5 to 10x up at a minimum. And that's after a 60% correction, you know, mm-hmm. like, right. So, but yeah, I'm pledging right now.
I think I'm pledging too, but I'm slacking.
Hang on.
We need a class sponsor for the podcast so that Aaron can pledge faster. Yeah. So, you know, we will shill anything. Anything.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, we've done an hour 13.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, we should wrap it up. Yeah.
Should we wrap it up?
Is there anything else we need to address?
I feel like we actually did a decent job of like covering some stuff.
I think so too.
We didn't even get into the environment, which is great.
I'm sad that we missed what is the definition of feminism.
Well, I just was interested in that one, but that one
you
I
just
like
want to hear like Isabel Vox and Duke's like perspective on the definition of feminism.
I'm very curious. Yeah. Can we just
God, do I even have a good answer? Yeah.
No, don't prep off the cuff. Just say words.
No, I was trying to figure out which wave of feminism you are.
My definition of feminism is different than, like, the waves, you know, like, the waves. I mean, my definition of feminism would just be, like, all genders are worthy of, like, are equally worthy of respect and honoring and celebration in their various forms. Well, I guess that's pretty, like, fourth wave.
That's pretty fourth wave.
Yeah.
what's fourth wave? What's the current wave?
So
we're on four.
We're in, okay. Like, yeah, it depends on who you ask, but, like, you know, so, like, first wave feminism basically is, like, literally, like, women getting the right to vote, mm-hmm. and, like, you know,
Women are human.
Women are not property. That's, like, feminism wave one is women aren't the property of men. Women actually should be able to, like, participate in elections. Wave two is more like women are just like men, and if you can do it, we can do it too. And it's like, you know, RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, like, we're gonna go to you work, make money, I'm gonna make money. You have a credit card, I get a credit card, you know, like, mm-hmm. it's that kind of thing. And so, you know, one of the criticisms of that second wave of feminism, even though it's incredibly important historically, obviously for obvious reasons, is that it doesn't really honor and celebrate femininity as being something that is valuable and like the feminine essence. Mm-hmm. As being something that's valuable. It's more about women kind of acting like men or being like men.
So, like, the second wave kind of devalued traditional women's work. Right, for example,
motherhood. That's right. Exactly. It was sort of more about women being able to participate in a men's world rather than women being valued in and of themselves.
Right.
Third wave is sort of when we get to the point where, like, you know, the classic example of third wave is like, we can do everything you can do, but we can do it in high heels, and it's okay that we're doing it in high heels, and, like, you know, feminists wear makeup too, and, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, it's this.
It's girl boss.
It's girl boss.
Yeah.
It's girl boss. It's third wave feminism is, there's like a little bit of a reclamation of femininity in the sense that, you know, it's like, you know, I can be a mom, have a job. It's the, you can have it all yeah. motto is third wave feminism. It's the, like, you know, you can do the, you can live in the man's world and also like wear high heels and look sexy. And that's not inherently anti-feminist. And then now we're fourth wave, I guess, is like when we fourth and fifth kind of blend together, they're sort of happening simultaneously. But yeah. so one of them is sort of like intersectionality, right? This sort of, and that's been going on for a long time since the 70s too. But I think that's sort of in its own kind of like cloud somewhere around the ether of feminism is intersectional feminism and making sure that you're, you know, incorporating feminism as it relates to other forms of equality and marginalization. And then where we are now, where I think you are,
I'm
where
trad.
I think I am.
Trad is kind of coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think, well, it depends. It's coming back in two ways. It's coming yeah. back in a kind of anti-feminist way, and it's also coming back in a feminist way. And there's a distinction. And I think the feminist way that it's coming back is this sort of idea that, you know, femininity should be valued as equally as men, as masculinity, right? And so, like, you know, women's work should be valued similarly, and we should not be like,
if you're not in the workforce, you're somehow less valuable as a person, right? You don't need to be a girl boss.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the anti-girl yeah. boss, yeah. like sort of like you can just be a yeah. mother at home and that's perfectly valid and good. You don't yeah. need to have it all. And actually it might be impossible to have it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of like critiquing that idea of like that being the goal that yeah. like right. everyone should strive for.
And there's different like levels and variations. Like once you start to get into these different waves, it starts to get really complicated really fast. Like there's like a whole like, you know, yogic tantra health world that's all about like, you know, celebrating
the
masculine
divine femininity.
The divine feminine
yoni
essence
centered
and right.
Feminism.
Yeah, yeah. There's yeah. yoni centered feminism.
That.
There's like, yeah, exactly, exactly. So it starts to get really diverse in how you define it. But yeah, I would say probably my like definition of feminism would be the honoring and respect of feminine and masculine as like equally worthy of respect and celebration.
See, that was worth hearing about.
Absolutely.
On the pod, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Love to hear it from a real girl boss herself.
I'm like a recovering girl boss. And when I say recovering, I mean it in like the AA way where it's like, you know, it's like a challenge every day to be in recovery from girl bossing.
To not girl boss.
Yeah, because
every
like,
day
because
you wake up.
We still do live in a culture where like girl bossing is like really encouraged. You have to
yeah.
like, it's really hard to actually be honoring the feminine in yourself.
Absolutely.
In a capitalist world, unless you're like cool being financially dependent, which I'm not.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and again, not because I think that that's bad and wrong, just a safety issue, just
yeah, yeah,
purely
yeah.
a safety issue. I want to be able to leave if I need to leave, you know,
yeah.
like straight up. And that, I mean, that goes, now we're looping back into first wave and why first wave needed to exist.
Yeah.
And second
the
wave.
Grand circle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, so that's where we're at.
Yeah, there we go.
Love to hear it.
Yeah,
and we educated Casey.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you feel educated? Do
Definitely.
You feel like that
Very
helped?
Educated.
Okay.
Yeah. Elucidated.
Okay.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's pretty much it. Isabel, thank you for
Thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Great. I hope you had fun.
Thank you.
I did.
Yep.
Yeah. And this episode will be up at some point. Please read Isabel's article, Bitcoin Magazine. It'll be linked down below. It's a great article.
Thank you.
Love to have you in the Bitcoiner community.
Thank you for having me on How Money Podcast.
Absolutely. Episode 4 in the books. Come back next week. Episode 5. We're going to be talking about coins. It's going to be a very nerdy episode. It's going to be great. We're going to have strings and pieces of paper and stamps and stuff. It's going to be good. We're going to LARP Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
See you next time.